Welcome to the Student Press Law Center podcast, a monthly rundown of news about legal developments affecting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is a nonprofit source of information and advocacy for the student media, and we work to break down the barriers that prevent college and high school journalists from doing their best work. For more information about the center, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lomani, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us. The job of any good photojournalist or videographer is to capture the shot. And capturing the shot often means getting close enough to the scene of mayhem to come into conflict with law enforcement. Over the past year, the tension between journalists' need for access to news events and the eagerness of police for control has come into especially sharp focus because of the arrests of journalists covering Occupy Wall Street and other Occupy protests across the country, including at least four arrested college student journalists. While the Supreme Court has very clearly defined the First Amendment right to publish news, the extent of a constitutional right to gather news remains somewhat less clear. But journalists have gotten some encouraging recent court rulings that indicate clearly that there is a constitutional right to record the activities of police performing their duties in a public place. Well, knowing the law is important, but in a crisis situation, it can be more important to know some diplomacy and some negotiating tactics to get your shot without going for a ride in the back of a squad car. Well, with us today to discuss both the law and the diplomacy of photojournalism is Mickey Oesterreicher. Mickey Oesterreicher is the general counsel to the National Press Photographers Association, which was founded in 1946 as an advocate for those working in the field of photojournalism. Mr. Oesterreicher himself was a photojournalist and videographer for many years before law school, working for the Buffalo Courier Express and for WKBW Television. He's also a former college journalist and college broadcaster at the University of Buffalo. He practices law with the law firm of Hiscock and Barclay, and he's a frequent speaker and trainer in the area of law and photojournalism. And in fact, he's calling us today from a Society of Professional Journalists workshop where he has been doing some training on this very subject. So thanks for making time to be with us, Ms. Mickey Oesterreicher. And just start off, give us a quick overview of what the National Press Photographers Association does and the benefits of being a member.
Well, as you mentioned, our organization was founded in 1946. Back then, really, still photographers and some newsreel photographers, to give photographers a voice. Many times back then and even now, photographers are found to sometimes be second-class citizens, though, as I often say, at least in television, without pictures, it's just radio. So it's really important for photographers to have a voice. We have a code of ethics. We have a mission statement. We have advocacy for photographers. We talk about many issues aside from access. Copyright issues are one of them. We certainly have the contests where people get to show their work and learn from others, and that's in both still and audiovisual recording. So it's a great organization. I myself have been a member since 1973. Even though I serve as the general counsel, I continue to pay my dues. I believe it's very important for the kind of work that we've been doing. And unfortunately or fortunately for me, I've had more than my share of it. As a matter of fact, they keep saying that the sign on my desk that says pound head here is starting to get worn out.
Well, one of these head pounders is a case that happened several months back up at one of these spinoff Occupy demonstrations up in Rochester, New York. And you, as a New York attorney, have been called into service. You're representing a college student journalist who was arrested and charged as a result of his work documenting police activity at Occupy Rochester. I guess tell us a little bit about that case and also maybe using that case as a takeoff point. How does that illustrate or exemplify some of the tensions that you are seeing out there between photojournalists and law enforcement generally?
Well, Jonathan Foster is an NPPA student member, and I'll put in a little plug here. Membership for students is greatly reduced, so I suggest people go on the NPPA website. It's www.npppa.org, and you can sign up online, and there are many student organizations around the country that you can be part of.
Right.
But anyway, Jonathan Foster is a photojournalism student at RIT, the Rochester Institute of Technology, and he was working for his publication, The Reporter. He was on assignment the night of October 29th. There were a number of Occupy protesters in Washington Square Park, even though that's in Rochester, not the famous one in New York.
Right.
And at some point, they decided, they being the police and the mayor, to invoke this very little used rule that says the park closes after 11. They wanted them out of there. So the police came and made an announcement and told people if they didn't leave that they would be arrested for trespassing. And Jonathan was there. He, being a student, didn't have press credentials. So he was there along with members of other traditional media.
Mm-hmm.
And he was photographing. There's lots of video of him going around. He'd actually put on a white T-shirt over his black raincoat that he was wearing. It was a chilly evening. And since his group is called The Reporter, it said Reporter. He tried to identify himself as a reporter, using professional camera gear. And as you can see on the tape, he was conducting himself the way a photojournalist would, taking pictures, moving around, stopping people who were being arrested and asking them for names, for cut line information, and so forth.
Right.
This went on for about half an hour, and he was in and out of the park along with the rest of the media. Park is traditionally a public forum. It's one of the most traditional public forums, and it's very rare that you can be cited for trespassing in a public place, but nevertheless, that's what they were doing, and they arrested about 30 people, and about half an hour, 45 minutes into this incident, they decided that Jonathan needed to be arrested, too. They said, okay, you're going, and so there's video of him being handcuffed and taken in, and then he was processed and fingerprinted and all of the things that happen once you're arrested. And then he was released, and I found out about this and was very concerned. He was charged with trespassing, which it's interesting because you can't be charged with taking pictures.
Right.
I mean, in a couple of states, and we'll talk about that later, I hope, have what are known as wiretap and eavesdropping laws, where if you record audio and intercept an oral conversation, even out in public, you're liable to for prosecution. But in terms of taking pictures, it's not unlawful. It's a part of free speech. It's a free expression, a free speech activity. And so most people who are arrested while they're taking pictures or recording are either charged with trespass or disorderly conduct or obstruction of governmental administration. So Jonathan was charged with trespass along with, as I said, about 30 other protesters. I made a motion to dismiss in the interest of justice. Normally, any charge involved the elements of most charges. The most important one is intent.
Mm-hmm.
Did you intend to do whatever it is you're being accused of doing? Jonathan's intent was not to trespass. Jonathan's intent was to cover a matter of public concern for his readers. My understanding is they publish once a week about 6,000 in-print copies and also online. So I made this motion. The Democrat and Chronicle, and which is the newspaper in Rochester, published an editorial saying that he shouldn't be charged, that they should drop the charges. It took them about 2 months, but they finally did drop the charges. And it turns out they dropped the charges against all of the protesters as well. But what we're finding more and more is that journalists are being arrested along with protesters when the police did not decide to distinguish between those covering an event and those participating in it.
Right. No, that's very troubling. Well, I do want to turn to that wiretapping issue that you mentioned, because we have seen that in a number of states which are called one-party consent states, right, where there is a statute which says that all parties to a conversation must consent to it being recorded, that the police at times will aggressively attempt to use these statutes as a tool to go after a videographer who happens to capture the audio of the police, let's say, making an arrest or doing some other police business in an otherwise public situation. Tell the audience about the Glick case, which came down from Massachusetts late last year, which seems sort of strike a blow at this legal theory and affirm that the rights of journalists to record police in just exactly that situation.
So as briefly as I can, Simon Glick was a Russian immigrant who came to this country for the very reasons that we're talking about and the very freedoms that we're talking about here today. And he went to school and he ended up becoming an attorney. So, and I can't make this stuff up. If I was doing a Hollywood script, I couldn't make it up. So he is walking through Boston Commons, the cradle of our liberty, where he hears somebody shout, "Stop, you're hurting him." And he looks over and he sees three Boston police officers trying to arrest somebody in the park. And he believed that they were using excessive force. So he took out his cell phone and he started to record. He was about 10 feet away. He was holding the cell phone out at arm's length. It was very obvious that he was open about recording. After the police effectuated that arrest, they turned around and looked at him and said, "Are you recording this?" And he said, "Yes." And they arrested him. And Massachusetts has a wiretap law that basically says you cannot record surreptitiously. He was not doing it surreptitiously. He was doing it openly. They also charged him with a number of other things, the disorderly conduct and the obstruction. And in his case, I also believe that they charged him with aiding in the escape of a prisoner.
That's right.
It was absurd. The district attorney realized it was absurd. And the charges were dismissed pretty quickly. Mr. Glick filed a complaint with the Internal Affairs Division of the Boston Police, and they basically said, "No, the officers were well within their rights to arrest you." Well, he decided not only would he sue the three officers, but now he would sue the city as well and the police because of the fact that they were negligent in their supervision and training. And the lower court, and this was in federal court, in no uncertain terms said that the police did not get qualified immunity. A lot of times, as you can imagine, police officers are out there, they're doing their job, they're trying their best, and people, for whatever reason, decide to sue them. And usually, if they're acting reasonably, as any other reasonable officer would have acted under similar circumstances, they get what's called qualified immunity, which means, sorry, you can't sue us.
Right.
But in this case, the court said, listen, the wiretap statute's very clear. You have to be recording secretly. You knew Mr. Glick wasn't doing that. You asked him it on tape. As a matter of fact, some of the recordings mysteriously disappeared while his cell phone was in their custody. But that unfortunately happens all too often. But at any rate, they admitted under oath that they knew he was recording, and the court said, no, you don't get qualified immunity, and we'll allow the case to proceed. Well, the city of Boston appealed, and it went to the First Circuit Court of Appeals, which is for that area, and they came out with a decision on August 31st of last year, where it's a 24-page decision. The case is called Glick, G-L-I-K-V, Kniff, C-U-N-N-I-F-F-E. Kniff is the name of one of the police officers. And it's a wonderful 24-page decision which talks about the rights of the public and the press and how they are coextensive with one another. It's one of the things that I talk about all the time, in that the press may not have any greater right than the public, but they certainly have no less right. It talks about how it's just as likely these days that news will come from a blogger or somebody with a cell phone than it will from somebody with a credential or working for a network or traditional media. And it just went on to say just a bunch of wonderful things, basically coming to the conclusion that the public has the right to record officers in public performing their duty. And that's the law in the First Circuit. Unfortunately, there are a number of circuits, court of appeals in the United States. And in the Seventh Circuit, which is in Illinois, we have another case. In Illinois has a state law, another wiretap law, and there they have two-party consent. Mm-hmm. Really, it's all-party consent. So if there's more than two people, it's got to be everybody's got to consent. The whole concept here in Massachusetts, in Illinois, it really doesn't matter where it is that when you were in public, there is no reasonable expectation of privacy.
Sure.
That's a very distinct term. It basically is what is how public is distinguished from private, which is why when we're outside every day, there are all these surveillance cameras and everybody takes our picture all the time and records us, because when you're in public, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Sure.
When you're in your home, you do. So in Illinois, for whatever reason, the legislature there saw fit to actually provide the police with a reasonable expectation of privacy, even when they're out in public performing their public duties.
Mm-hmm.
And the ACLU in Illinois brought suit and asked for declaratory judgment. They weren't doing what Mr. Glick did in terms of suing the police, but they were asking the court to take a look at this law and declare it unconstitutional. And then they're also looking for injunctive relief in order for them to not be able to further use this law. And that case was argued in October of last year in front of the Seventh Circuit. If you go online and you Google it and you go to the Seventh Circuit, you can actually listen to the oral argument online. And unfortunately, Judge Posner, who was one of the three judges on a three-judge panel to hear the oral arguments here, was asking the most bizarre questions from my point of view. I mean, he was saying, well, what about these snoopers? And he was really confusing public with private, recording with broadcast. And I'm quite frankly concerned about how they're going to decide this. Interesting, and what's very timely here, is that there have been a number of people charged under that statute. The one example is a woman who had called the police because her boyfriend beat her up. It was a domestic, and the police came. And for whatever reason, it's alleged that one of the police officers, while he was there, you know, taking a report of this crime, decided that would be a good time to ask this woman out.
Right.
And she, you know, kind of took offense at that since, you know, she just thought that that was not appropriate. So she went down to Internal Affairs to file a complaint, at which point it seemed like Internal Affairs were trying to talk her out of filing the complaint rather than just taking the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
She said, this isn't going so well. So she, too, decided to record this. Whereupon, when they realized that, they arrested her, and they charged her under the wiretap law. Case went to trial. Jury found within an hour that she was not guilty, and because there happens to be an exception to that law that if you believe a crime is being committed, you can record.
Right.
So she got out of that on the loophole. But there have been other cases that have occurred where people have been charged, and one of them was the People v. Allison, which involved a gentleman who was out on the street, and he was kind of selling things, and the police came along to arrest him. He was like a street vendor, and he recorded them, and they ended up charging him. And in that case that just went to trial not too long ago, the judge found the law unconstitutional. Now, this is in a lower state court. Just today, the state filed an appeal of that. Now, you know, you can't have double jeopardy. If you're found not guilty under the law, the people cannot appeal. But because he found the law unconstitutional and never reached the conclusion as to whether or not he was guilty or not of violating this law, the state can appeal, and they did appeal. So we're going to see where that goes.
Right.
Another thing happened today, which was really disturbing as well, and that is, you know, while we're waiting for the Seventh Circuit to decide what's going on in ACLU v. Alvarez, the General Assembly in Illinois, one of the legislators there, proposed the bill that would amend the wiretap law to bring it more in line with what the other states have. Mm-hmm. And that was actually killed today on the floor of the General Assembly.
Oh, how about that?
The big concern really here is that you've got the NATO summit coming up in Chicago in May. But the problem is that you're going to have journalists coming to the land of the free and the home of the brave from all around the world to cover this NATO summit and all around this country, which I have no idea that Illinois is in a world of its own and has this this wiretap law on
right.
the books.
Right.
And it will not surprise me if journalists are arrested and charged with this law. And the real problem there is it's very draconian. It's a felony as opposed to a misdemeanor. Most of the other things I talked about, disorderly and trespassing and obstruction, they're all misdemeanors.
Right.
Not to minimize things, but this is a felony, and if you're convicted, the penalty is 15 years in jail. So you know, that is of great concern, not to just the press, but anybody who records in public. So, you know, I tried to kind of give this overview of what's going on, but the real problem is that students and citizens and journalists are all being affected by the police, who seem to be, and one of the things I talk about is I believe that it's in the police culture that this idea of serve and protect often means to them that it's their job to protect citizens from having a picture taken.
Right.
Outside.
Right.
And,
right.
And you know, many times journalists tell me the police, you know, said, "Well, would you want your mother on TV? You know, if she was involved in this accident?" And the point is, it's not their job.
Sure.
Just as a photographer's job would not be to stop and direct traffic, their job is to investigate crimes. It's public safety. It's not to decide what is and isn't a news story, what is and isn't proper. And so all of this, to me, you know, forms this whole idea of catch and release, because many times, you know, journalists are arrested and then they're let go, but in the meantime, the police have stopped them from doing what it is, what their function is, to be out there to report.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I talk about all the time is we've looked at the video from the Arab Spring. We've looked at video that's come from Libya and from Syria, and we've seen people risk their lives, you know, citizens captured on cell phone video, journalists, photojournalists have been killed covering these uprisings. And what's interesting is we watch these things on television, and we think how heroic of
right.
these people to risk their lives. And yet, those same types of things, those same images that are being recorded there and are looked at as heroic, are looked at as suspect in this country.
Right.
And
let's leave it there because we're about out of time, and I've got to wrap it up. I want to say thank you quickly to Ms. Mickey Oesterreicher of the NPPA for being our guest and for all of his work and all the NPPA's work in defending the rights of journalists. Again, their website is www.npppa.org. We also help you check out the resources available to you on the Student Press Law Center website, www.splc.org. And we want to thank you for listening.